This evening, I'd like to carry you through some scriptures. I have a number listed here in no particular order. I was led to jot a couple of these down after last week's sermon and this morning's, both of which, as speakers would say, are going to be tough acts to follow. Last week, Brother Glenn spoke to you about a subject that is prevalent in the world, one that's not awfully nice to talk about, but which, to be practical, we have to face. He discussed pornography. This morning, our speaker discussed the responsibilities to the gospel and brought it to us on a personal level and people's decision pertaining to baptism. And so tonight, following on an extension of some of those scriptures, I'd like to kind of continue the thought. A particular word has struck me out of the scriptures, one which I think maybe we misread sometimes and maybe misapply. So I want to go to 1 John, 2nd chapter. That's the first epistle of John, 2nd chapter. And I want to start with the 15th verse. It says, "Love not the world, neither the things that are in the world. If any man love the world, the love of the Father is not in him." And then the 16th, "For all that is in the world, the lust of the flesh, the lust of the eyes, and pride of life, is not of the Father, but is of the world." Glenn spoke to that lust of the eyes last week. That was his subject. And I think you got some very pointed thoughts. Tonight, I want to discuss that word, lust, and do it in a general context. Because I think so many times we read the scriptures and we think of it in terms of the verse that just preceded lust of the eyes there in the 16th verse. It says lust of the flesh, and then it says lust of the eyes. And I want to speak to you about that word, lust. What does it mean? We had a test right now. You know, I'm famous for having tests. What would your definition be? What would you define it as? And I'll bet we might even get as many answers as we have people in the room. It may even vary as to how it's used in the sentence, in the various scriptures. So we'll look at a few of those. Let's go to 1 Corinthians. And the 10th chapter. Before I read this verse, I will comment that in a Bible dictionary of the day, one that definitions that are accepted by the theologians, it says that the definition of the word lust in its basic or general context is that of pleasure. Now, if any of you thought that's the way you would define the word, we'll give you credit for that on your test. Not necessarily evil. Does that surprise you? Not necessarily evil. Depends on what you're lusting after, I suppose, and what that pleasure might be. Here in the 6th verse of the 10th chapter of 1 Corinthians, it says, "Now these things were our examples, to the extent we should not lust after evil things, as they also lusted." Now, of course, I've picked one verse out. I've read you the words. You don't know who the they are and what they were doing, but that's not really pertinent right here at the moment. The fact of the matter is that it says the intent that we, whoever the we are, should not lust after evil things. Definitely showing that this fits the example of the definition I just gave you. The word lust by itself doesn't have to mean evil. And in this particular place, it says, don't lust after evil things. Now, it's up to us to take from the scripture or guides or society what those evil things are. But at any rate, we shouldn't lust after evil things. Let's go back to Exodus. Way back to Exodus. Chapter 15. This is the story of Moses and how they crossed the Red Sea, and how the sea covered up Pharaoh's chariots. But again, that story isn't the important thing. I want to pick out a verse, and we want to look at some words here. It's verse 9, chapter 15 of Exodus. The enemy said, I will pursue, I will divide, I'm sorry, I will pursue, I will overtake, I will divide the spoil. My lust shall be satisfied upon them. I will draw my sword. My hand shall destroy them. And so at this point, I think we can put in a second word as a definition for lust. Pleasure would be the one we gave before, but I think the more general one here, we could say desire. If you replace the word there with the word desire, you would say, my desire shall be satisfied upon them. I will draw my sword. My hand shall destroy them. Because Pharaoh's men were pursuing the Israelites, and that was their desire. Kill them. That was their lust. That was, if you want to look at killing, their pleasure. They were warlike, men trained in that, charioteers. And that was their desire, and that was their lust. Well, how does that pertain to us? That word lust is used in admonitions throughout the scriptures. And we're told to or not to lust. Let's go to the book of James. Let's look at the first chapter. This is a favorite scripture of mine. I've used it a number of times, but I've noticed that so do some of your other ministry. Starting somewhere around the 12th, 13th, 14th verse. Let's start with the 12th. Blessed is the man that endureth temptation, for when he is tried, he shall receive the crown of life which the Lord hath promised to them that love him. Let no man say when he is tempted, I am tempted of God. That's a whole other sermon right there. We'll skip that for tonight. For God cannot be tempted with evil, neither tempted he any man. But every man is tempted when he is drawn away of his own lust and enticed. Then when lust hath conceived, it bringeth forth sin, and sin, when it is finished, bringeth forth death. I think this is the part that begins to apply to us. If we see that we are seeking some form of pleasure, whatever it is, and again, not necessarily evil in and of itself, and you desire it, that is a lust. Now, I would venture to say most of you don't consider that lusting. If you desire to have fun tonight doing whatever it is, be it watching TV or going shopping or whatever. Depends, I suppose, on what you're watching or what you're shopping for. But the word lust has a broad connotation if you think of it in those terms. And I venture to say most of us don't think about lusting. Do we? Do we lust after anything? If we switch over here to chapter 4 in James, and let's start with just read the very beginning here of the chapter. From whence come wars and fightings among you? Come they not hence even of your lusts that war in your members? Now, you think of war as putting on uniforms, carrying weapons, and going out against nation, but not necessarily so. You notice it says here, even of your lust that war in your members. You can war in your members. We call it contention today within the church. We call it factionalism. Taking sides. You know, he thinks that and I think this and, boy, I'm going to get him. And that's war. Small scale, but that's war. And it says here, even of your lusts that war in your members. Because when you do something like that, you do it out of a conviction, don't you? Or at least you should, I would hope. If you argue for a point, you don't do it just for the fun of it. Well, maybe some do. Maybe that's the lust. One up the other guy. Maybe what you're arguing about isn't really all that important. Maybe it's not really evil in and of itself, but to create the disturbance, get somebody riled up. Have you ever known people who like to do that just for kicks? I see some heads bobbing, yes. Okay. That's conceived out of lust. I suppose there's lust for power and other things, but let's read on. It says, ye lust and have not, ye kill and desire to have, and cannot obtain. You fight in war, yet ye have not, because you ask not. You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss. Now listen to this. You ask and receive not, because you ask amiss. And I think this was alluded to this morning and also last week, and in other sermons also, but those I remember, that you may consume it upon your lusts. How often do we ask for things? Here we're talking about asking the Lord or asking for help, that it may be consumed upon your lusts. Depends on what you're doing. When we're doing things and we're asking, I remember my Uncle Bill once preached a sermon, and he said, do you really want that prayer that you've just offered answered? Are you ready to get the answer to that prayer? You have to think about it. I'm going to skip verse 4. It speaks of some evil, but I want to stay in generalities at the moment. Let's go to verse 5. Do you think that the Scripture saith in vain, the Spirit that dwelleth in us lusteth to envy? It shouldn't. Envy can be evil. And the Spirit we would hope that would dwelleth in us is the Spirit of God. But that's up to us. And if a spirit lusteth to envy, and that's a human trait, envying something someone else has, something they're doing. Well, he got that promotion and I should have had it. Right? Or you got a raise, I didn't get one. It's really easy to lust. And I'll bet in those kind of situations, you don't think of that as lust. And that's what I hope to show this evening. It was something which kind of came to me from the other sermons. I had never really looked at the word and the definition and the use quite that way. We always attribute the word lust, or I think when somebody says something like that, don't you automatically think of the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not commit adultery? We think of the physical lust. Oh, there's that too. And the one Glenn spoke about last week, the pornographic. But there's more to it than that, and just as bad. That's probably really the bad part about it. Just as bad. Sometimes maybe not as gross, and so we overlook it. We poo-poo it, as they say. We put it aside. Oh, it's just a little, you know. Well, I said that, but I didn't really mean it. But if it's really lust, If it dwelleth in you, lusteth to envy. Let's go to verse 8. It says, draw nigh to God, and he will draw nigh to you. Cleanse your hands, ye sinners, and purify your hearts, ye double-minded. And I suppose I've got about three ways I can go on this now, and I've got so many thoughts, I don't know which one to pursue. But double-minded. Do you ever think of yourself as double-minded? I have been double-minded. It's not right. It produces sin. The worst probably is I might address parents. Let's start with parents. Tells the child, no, you can't do that. And then does it. Well, but I'm older than you are, and you've heard that excuse. Or when you're big enough, and you can make your own decisions, but until then. We have a problem in the church today, as a matter of fact. Look about us. The number of young people we have that are not baptized. I spoke to Frank Fan at the East Local the other night about this. I spoke to Brother Lee about this morning. I said, are we doing something wrong? Or we're not doing something right? I think Lee said, we aren't doing something right enough. And I'm sure that we don't think of ourselves as double-minded. I don't like to think of myself as double-minded. But you know, I think we're guilty. I think I'm guilty. I think we're all guilty. Assess yourselves. A phrase I learned as a kid. Do you practice what you preach? We have church families who tolerate tobacco in their homes, who have wine in the refrigerator, and it's not for sacrament. We spoke about the pornographic things last week, TV shows, the VCR, number of things like that that get tolerated. You can't be 100% on the job all the time as a referee, as a chaperone. It's tough. I know. My kids are grown and out of the home. Well, except my little one. But when they were there, you know, years later, you say, boy, I'm sure glad you guys didn't do that. One of them will kind of hang their head and they'll say, little did you know. And then you hear the story. I was talking with a fellow at the wedding last night. It was after the wedding, and talking about being in a civic committee serving, and they were talking about drugs and things going on, and they were trying to figure out how to handle it. And the civic committee was, you know, they were the city fathers, and how should we go to the school board, and what should we do, and everything. And one of the guys who was one of the members of the committee spoke right up and said, well, by golly, my daughter doesn't do that, and I'm sure that she isn't there, and I'll tell you what we ought to do. And he had all the answers. The interesting thing was the other half of the committee knew that the daughter had been at one of the parties recently. You see, one of the members on the committee was the sheriff's deputy, and he'd raided the party, and he knew who was there. And so you got to lay the groundwork. You have to know that what you've taught is being followed, and then remember, children are human beings. They have a choice, and they may not always obey. And you may not like it. And you may reprimand them. It's still sin. Well, let's quit picking on parents. In that vein. Let's pick on the priesthood. The priesthood preach. They tell how it ought to be. They read these scriptures. by and large, I think they maybe have a responsibility to set a bigger, more responsible example than maybe even parents before children. And quite often they err. Some of the mistakes are honest mistakes. The old, what we call the foot and mouth disease, you know, you say something and it's out before you know it's out, and maybe you didn't mean it that way, but who heard you? Or it's really interesting that the average run-of-the-mill fellow that you know on the street doesn't think anything about being seen in various types of business enterprises, the pub, the liquor store, and so forth. But if he sees his minister, it doesn't matter what church, whether it's this one or somebody else's, but a minister coming out of one of those places, the thought never is, well, why was he in there? But just that they saw him coming out, and the judgment is made right on the spot. And the minister ought to have a real good reason for why he's where he is, because he's setting an example, and he's going to be seen. That's a real simple, easy example. There are others. And we have these problems among us, but then do we think of them in terms of being based on lust? To bring us back to our subject, do we think about that? Let's turn to Revelation. It's close here to James. Let's go to the 18th chapter of Revelation. Now, we don't think of Revelation as like in the Gospels, where it lays down directions of things to do, more as prophecy in the future. But let's look at the 18th chapter of Revelation, and I think we're going to look at verse... go up here to verse 10 or 11, I guess, to start. This is based on prophecy. It's talking about the fall of Babylon, verse 10. And then in starting with verse 11, it says, "And the merchants of the earth shall weep and mourn over her, Babylon, having fallen. For no man buyeth their merchandise anymore, the merchandise of gold and silver and precious stones and of pearls, fine linen, purple and silk, and scarlet, and all fine wood, and all manner of vessels of ivory, and all manner of vessels of most precious wood, and of brass, and iron, and marble, and cinnamon, and odors, and ointments, and frankincense, and wine, and oil, and fine flour, and wheat, and beasts, sheep, and horses, and chariots, and slaves, and souls of men." All of that commerce leading up to slaves and souls of men. And then here's verse 14. "And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee, and all things which were dainty and goodly are departed from thee, and thou shalt find them no more at all." Aha. "And the fruits that thy soul lusted after..." And then we go back to all of this list of commerce, which I suppose, if you look at it, are the basic items for just about anything that works or is purchasable or a fine thing today, be it clothes, car, furniture, homes, foods, livestock, depending on how you use those commodities there, you can just about name anything. And it says, "And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee." If you desire those things, I know people who are into raising horses. I've got a lot of friends who are Sunday morning golfers. And there are other things I'm sure you can think about. But you know, we shouldn't point our finger at the world or our friends or people we know, but at ourselves. What do we do that we place a priority on? Oh, I'm not talking about your job where you have to go to work earn the money, that you support your family, from which you pay your tithes. But the things associated with it, your after hours, your before hours, your weekends. What do you use your time for? What do you use your extra money for? Where do you invest it? What are your goals? What is something that's really important to your heart? What do you really want? Do you place a lot of value in? If you went home tonight and discovered some item, that one thing, somebody had broken in and was gone, they'd stolen it. I know that some of you have had that experience and have lost things. What's the attitude? You can analyze yourself that way. Is the immediate attitude, oh my, and you just wring your hands and you're despondent, and or is it, oh well, I'll turn that into the insurance company, I can probably get another and it'll work as well. What is your attitude towards your loss? What is the one important thing in this world? Where if you should lose it, you would be despondent. You would be fearful. Soul. Saw that on several lips. And what else is that important? Have you ever lost something, you put it aside and you couldn't find it, and you just sort of went berserk? You know, your everything else was put aside. Your wife wanted you to do something. I haven't got time now. I got to find it. You know, what's important? Priorities. And do you think about that? The thought that goes into that action and those thoughts comes from the heart, where you place your priorities. What you think about that object, is it lust? Do you think about that as lust? I'll bet not. Double-minded. And the fruits that thy soul lusted after are departed from thee. Let's go to 2 Peter. The first chapter. I guess I'll have to start up here to make a little sense at the very first verse in chapter 1 of 2 Peter. Simon Peter, a servant and an apostle of Jesus Christ, to them that have obtained like precious faith with us through the righteousness of God and our Savior Jesus Christ. Grace and peace be multiplied unto you through the knowledge of God and of Jesus our Lord, according as his divine power hath given unto us all things that pertain unto life and godliness, through the knowledge of him that hath called us to glory and virtue. Now verse 4, whereby are given unto us exceeding great and precious promises, that by these you might be partakers of the divine nature, having escaped the corruption that is in the world through lust. Corruption that is in the world through lust. There are people who are driven by association, by titles, by power. And you think about them being at levels of community leadership, presidents, senators. You know, it's always they out there, the other guy. But what about yourself in your own organizations, at work, in your committees, in your groups? Little twinges of lust and corruption. Finagling to get some guy to take a shift so that you won't have to work that shift, or and for what reason? or to promote something that you want passed, even if it's in a church business meeting or a conference meeting? Or what is the real thought, the basis of signing petitions and something that on the surface looks like it ought to be a good thing that needs to be taken care of? Who has an axe to grind, as we say, and will it lead to evil? Is it really promoted through some person's conception, a lust from within, something in their heart they desire? And you may become part of it. Maybe you started it. Corruption that is in the world through lust. I want to get to a story that you all know about and not keep you overly long tonight. Let's look at 2 Timothy. Chapter 2, and let me see, somewhere around verse 19, 20, it's talking, about the various things that are in a house. It's talking about vessels of gold and silver and of wood. Kind of a parallel as to what's mentioned in Revelation. But it's talking about your desires for these and what should be to honor and what should be to dishonor. So I'll start at verse 20. It says, "But in a great house there are not only vessels of gold and of silver, but also of wood and of earth, and some to honor and some to dishonor. If a man therefore purge himself from these, he shall be a vessel unto honor, sanctified and meet for the master's use and prepared unto every good work." And then verse 22, "Flee also youthful lusts, but follow righteousness, faith, charity, peace with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart." And I'll venture to say that 90% of the people, if you ask them what they to define or list, give me a list of youthful lusts. At the head of that is probably sex. That's the first thing that probably will pop into most people's minds if you ask them. But that's not the whole story. Well, that may be a problem, yes, but youthful lusts. In your youthful vigor, in your physical stature, your ability to do things and move faster, the things that you young fellows can do quicker now than I can, your ability and your desires at competition, sports, physical fitness, I suppose, if it goes along with sports. The fact that youth are prone or pulled to be active, you know, it's like the little children. They have a terrible time sitting still. They got to be doing things. They're active. They're trying to burn off those calories. Your teenagers are the same way. Your college people are the same way. I can remember when I was a teenager, my uncles and aunts used to come to visit, and they sat around and talked or read the paper. And I just, you know, I wanted to do something. Gee, I had to sit there and behave myself and listen and be polite. I wanted to go out and do something. I had places to go and worlds to conquer. But there's lust in there somewhere. Not necessarily evil, but it can lead to it. That's the problem. Our young people, and I'm not talking teenagers now, I'm talking about our young marrieds right now, are faced with this in the world out there. There are a myriad of things for them to do and places to go and stuff to get into. Not necessarily evil, but it will lead there if they're not careful. And where do you draw the line? How do you look at it? You have to analyze yourself and answer that question. I can't make the decision. No, that'd be easy. Take me along and I can say, yeah, you can do this, you can't do that. But you can't be there all the time. Verse 23 changes the scene a little. In verse 22 it says, flee also youthful lusts, but follow righteousness, faith, charity, peace with them that call on the Lord out of a pure heart. In verse 23, but foolish and unlearned questions avoid, knowing that they do gender strifes. We're faced with that. This church, other churches, the restoration. In fact, we have a tough time staying out of it, you know. Foolish and unlearned questions avoid. There are so many things that we hypothesize. We don't know the answers to, but we argue about it like we did. Or we may have a personal conviction that that's the way we want it to be, if we will be honest and look at ourselves. But a lot of things we can't prove. You don't know. One exception to that prophecy. If the Lord tells you, then you know. But without that, avoid foolish and unlearned questions, knowing they do gender strifes. And is the reason for getting into that, the arguments, is there a lust involved? Why? To be smarter than the other guy, one-upping? You have something you want to do with that? You want to put something over? Or you just like to argue? Now the story that I wanted to get to. Let's go back to Numbers. Chapter 11. Verse 4. This is the story of the Israelites at the time that they were in the wilderness and they were having a terrible problem. They were having a terrible problem with their food and supporting their people and keeping them in line. Moses was having a terrible problem. And so the Lord gave him the manna. And remember, they went out and collected it. Except for one day they weren't supposed to, so then they collected enough to last over the Sabbath. That was the one day they could collect it and keep it and it wouldn't spoil. Remember the story about the manna? And the people thought this was great, but they got tired of it real quick. And they said, we want meat to eat. As among them fell a lusting, and the children of Israel also wept and said, who shall give us flesh to eat? It says in here that the Lord considered their desire. For meat over the manna he had given them, lust. Now, I'll bet none of you would have attributed that to a lustful condition. I said, oh, if I could just have a McDonald's, you know, if I could just have some meat. I'm tired of this manna. I'd have probably said, if somebody asked me, what do you call that? I'd have said rebellion. God said it was lust. And rather than read you out of the whole Numbers here, it turns out that this story is told in the 78th Psalm. And it's paraphrased better than I'd do it, so I think I'll read it to you. I'm going to start at about verse 12 in the 78th Psalm. Marvelous things did he in the sight of their fathers in the land of Egypt, in the field of Zoan. He divided the sea and caused them to pass through. He made the waters to stand as an heap. In the daytime also he led them with a cloud, and all the night with a light of fire. He clave the rocks in the wilderness and gave them drink as out of the great depths. He brought streams also out of the rock and caused waters to run down like rivers. And they sinned yet more against him by provoking the Most High in the wilderness. And they tempted God in their heart by asking meat for their lust. Isn't that interesting? Yea, they spake against God. They said, Can God furnish a table in the wilderness? Behold, he smote the rock that the waters gushed out, and the streams overflowed. Can he give bread also? Can he provide flesh for his people? Therefore the Lord heard this and was wroth. So a fire was kindled against Jacob, and anger also came up against Israel, because they believed not in God and trusted not in his salvation. In the case of this particular lust, that was what was at the bottom of it. No trust. Though he had commanded the clouds from above and opened the doors of heaven, and he had rained down manna upon them to eat and had given them of the corn of heaven, man did eat angels' food. He sent them meat to the full. He caused an east wind to blow in the heaven, and by his power he brought in the south wind. He rained flesh also upon them as dust, and feathered fowls like as the sand of the sea. And he let it fall in the midst of their camp round about their habitations. Remember? He gave them doves. So they did eat and were filled, for he gave them their own desire. That's the other interesting thing. If they desired it, then he gave it to them. They were not estranged from their lust. But while their meat was yet in their mouths, the wrath of God came upon them and slew the fattest of them and smote down the chosen men of Israel. For all this they sinned still and believed not for his wondrous works. Therefore their days did he consume in vanity and their years in trouble. I went out to dinner last night with some relatives. You don't usually think of desiring an evening out and a dinner meal as lustful. I'm serious. Maybe we should reevaluate our priorities. Does something become a burning desire? I looked up a word, concupiscence. It shows up in the scriptures, and I discovered when I looked it up that it means an ardent desire. And a lot of times it's attributed to the sexual sins, but it doesn't have to be. That's the common one. That's what people would think of if you said, what does concupiscence mean? They would say lust in terms of sexual desire. Oh, it is. But ardent desires, like the Israelites had here for this meat, where they wouldn't be satisfied with what God had given them in the form of a commandment, was a form of concupiscence, and it was lust generated, and it brought forth sin. I'd never thought of that before, had you? Read that 78th Psalm. Well, I think maybe after having gone through that series of scriptures and talking about it in context of the Bible, we ought to look at the Book of Mormon just a little bit. Let's go to 1 Nephi and the first chapter. You remember the story where Nephi was to go up to Laban and get the plates? And in fact, he ended up doing just that. But something happened in the process of that, and that's what I want to read to you about. I'm going to start at verse 87 on page 9 of the Book of Mormon. This first book of Nephi. First chapter. And it came to pass that we went in unto Laban and desired him that he would give unto us the records which were engraven upon the plates of brass, for which we would give unto him our gold and our silver and all our precious things. And it came to pass that when Laban saw our property, that it was exceeding great, he did lust after it. Let's pull the word lust out. We'll stick in desire. He did desire it, insomuch that he thrust us out and sent his servants to slay us, that he might obtain our property. There's a lust that had to do with property. Getting something that doesn't belong to you, belongs to somebody else, and you want it. And then if we go back to page 712, it's not the end of the Book of Mormon, but going from the front to the back, this is in the Book of Mormon, chapter 4, and let's see. I guess I'll just read 94. Right at the bottom of the page, 712. Be wise in the days of your probation. Strip yourselves of all uncleanliness or uncleanness. Ask not that you may consume it on your lusts, but ask with a firmness unshaken that you will yield to no temptation, but that you will serve the true and living God. I'm going to read that again. Be wise in the days of your probation. We're not talking about the other guy. We're talking about us. And for us, that's now. Okay? Strip yourselves of all uncleanness. For me, only I can do that. For you, only you can do that. Ask not that you may consume it on your lusts. Do you ask for things for which you have a desire or a thought that will either get you into trouble or really isn't right? But ask with a firmness unshaken that ye will yield to no temptation. That means that whatever you do won't get you into trouble. I don't know about you, but there aren't many things out there today that are like that. Even the most innocent can get you into trouble. But that you will serve the true and living God. And of course, to do that, you keep his commandments. I had a couple of other thoughts here tonight, and they were ministry oriented. I think I'll save them for another time. I think that we need to look at the practical aspect of the gospel in our life. We need to evaluate the places we go, the things that we do, and the people we do them with. It's going to mean giving up things if you give the right answers, in my opinion. And that's my admonition to all of you. The things that are offered that are pleasing in the world. And you don't have to go to a bar. I'm not talking about the gross things that everybody knows about. It's like a spider web. And things will entrap you. You get stuck in it. You ever been walking down a forest trail? Or an old set of basement stairs will do just as well. And you walk right into a cobweb, you didn't see it coming, gets you right in the face. You can spend a lot of time picking that all off. But how quick did you get into it? Just like that. stops you in your tracks, you are immobilized. Maybe not hurt right then and there by that object, but it had that effect. And the traps out there are that way. And so you have to analyze what you're doing. For those in position of responsibility, your finances, your desire to gain and get ahead, to make a way, is it for just security and to get along, or are you trying to lay up some of those stores that will rot, you know, that moth and rust will get to, that the scriptures talk about? You have to answer that. I suspect a lot of us are guilty of that. I've had to reorganize my priorities. Have you? God's commandments are simple. They're easy. Keeping them in the face of adversity is not always that simple and that easy. But that's our test. And God promises that if we try, if we do our level best, as it said in the Book of Mormon, if we ask with an eye single to keeping His commandments, that we won't be, as the Lord's Prayer says, led into temptation. By our own actions, by some innocent desire conceived in lust. The next time you're tempted in any kind of an act or any kind of a decision, think of it in those terms and analyze it. We need to pray for each other. We need to counsel each other. When we see a brother or a sister about to make a wrong decision, warn them about it. Oh, don't be heavy-handed and give them the old Simon Legree, "Don't you do that." You know, there's a nice way to approach things, but a firm way. It's a fine line. The road is narrow. But you can do it. Let us all pray for one another. Thank you.
Thank you, Alan. Let's keep in mind prayer service on Wednesday, and the Sunday School business meeting on Thursday evening. We'll close with the use of number 314. Yes. Yes. Okay. Brother Maynard, Brother Leroy, would you? Let's close this evening's service with the use of number 314. Brother Maynard, could I ask you for the closing prayer, please? Okay. Number 314.